In a time like none of us have experienced before, there's strength to be found in community institutions like Iowa Public Radio. I'm Executive Director Myrna Johnson, and I'm so proud of the thoughtful, informed coverage IPR brings you on the issues that matter. Listener funding is the power source that makes it all possible. Facts, understanding, insight, that's what you fund when you give to this station. Make your gift now at iowapublicradio.org, and thank you.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us, Rachel Caulfield, Professor of Political Science at Drake University in Des Moines. Rachel, good to have you on this program for the very last politics day of 2020. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jonathan Hasid with us as well, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jonathan, good to have you on board as well.
Good to be here, Ben.
We'd like to invite our listeners to join our conversation if you'd like to have any concluding questions or remarks as we close out 2020 in politics. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. I'll be asking Jonathan and Rachel for their reflections on the political year 2020 later in the program. Perhaps you have a specific question along those lines. Or, as we typically do at the year's end, cast our gaze forward into 2021 to look at hopes, perhaps fears that you have. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Later in the hour, also, we'll talk about the president perhaps facing his first veto override of his term, and President-elect Biden saying vaccines are being distributed too slowly. He vows to speed that up, and let's address, though, this breaking news within the last few minutes. Jonathan and Rachel, I wonder if you've been alerted to this. We have majority Democrats in the U.S. House evidently will allow the Iowa Republican Marionette Miller-Meeks to take office while they review her opponent's contest, claiming the six-vote race was wrongly decided. This comes from Speaker Nancy Pelosi today. Within the last few minutes, Pelosi said yes when asked at a news conference whether Marionette Miller Meeks will be sworn in with other members of the House this coming Sunday. They said they intend to provisionally seat Miller Meeks pending the outcome of the challenge filed last week by her Democratic opponent, Rita Hart. This little news development, perhaps you can comment on that, Rachel. This was probably expected to seat, but seat provisionally, right?
Right. Yeah. So the House is the sole judge of the election returns for members of the House, and so anybody who has a question about election returns in their district, they can appeal directly to the House of Representatives, as Rita Hart has done. But in the meantime, given the results that have been certified within Iowa, it's perfectly appropriate that the Speaker of the House would seat Miller Meeks as the current elected representative for Iowa's 2nd Congressional District.
Okay. We'll keep our eyes on that. Let's move on to the stimulus package. Yesterday, Democratic Senate leader, the minority leader, Chuck Schumer, encouraged the Senate to approve an increased stimulus and veto override to get the $2,000 checks into the hands of many Americans who haven't received such stimulus payments since the very early months of the pandemic. Let's listen to Chuck Schumer speaking on the floor of the Senate yesterday.
Throughout this pandemic, working Americans have taken it on the chin. Right now, they're facing their hardest and their darkest days. Tens of millions have lost their jobs. Tens of millions are struggling to put food on the table, keep a roof over their heads. In the wealthiest nation on earth, modern-day bread lines stretch for miles down American highways. The fastest way to get money into Americans' pockets is to send some of their tax dollars right back from where they came. $2,000 stimulus checks could mean the difference between American families having groceries for a few extra weeks or going hungry.
Now, yesterday, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, blocked a Democratic attempt to increase these direct stimulus checks to $2,000 from that $600. Instead, McConnell said the Senate would, in his words, begin the process of discussing the checks as well as two other issues that the president has demanded lawmakers address: election security, also removing legal protections from social media platforms. Jonathan, take this one. What's going on here?
Well, it's a very interesting split inside the GOP. The president rather abruptly decided that, he wasn't going to sign the stimulus bill because he wanted larger checks. He wanted them to go from $600 to $2,000. But then, of course, he abruptly changed his mind and did sign it. But in the meantime, he's tweeting that, among his various fraudulent claims of a stolen election, he's also tweeting about that there need to be higher stimulus checks, which is something that Nancy Pelosi is delighted about, right? So she's this is, potentially an issue in the Georgia Senate race. We've already seen both Georgia senators, both Perdue and Loeffler, come down on the side of increasing to $2,000, which is not something they were interested in before. But basically, the president has put many members of the Republican Party in a very tight spot. These are people who are complaining about the deficit, especially as Biden is coming in. Their deficit worries are really ramping up. And now the House is passing a bill that wants to basically increase the deficit by another $450 billion to get checks to Americans. And so this is going to be a real fight inside the Senate GOP in particular. I suspect that it's not going to happen, would be my guess. Mitch McConnell seems to be pretty clear that he's going to kill it. But I can't imagine he's pleased with the president right now.
Yeah, right. The president's tweet that you referred to, Jonathan, let me read it verbatim, at least one of them on this. I'm not sure how many of them have been on this topic. The president tweeting, "Unless Republicans have a death wish, and it is also the right thing to do, they must approve the $2,000 payments ASAP. $600 is not enough." Rachel, weigh in on this.
This is, as Jonathan indicated, this is a really interesting split in the waning days of the Trump administration between President Trump and Senate Republicans in particular. Mitch McConnell, of course, is known as a tactician extraordinaire on the floor of the Senate. And in this case, yesterday, he stepped forward and he said, "Sure, I'll consider $2,000. But I will only do it if it is linked to two other provisions that the president has asked for. One is a commission investigating election security, and one is this elimination of a liability shield, basically, for social media companies under the Communications Decency Act. It's known as Section 230. And both of those provisions are seen as poison pills, in the sense that Democrats are unlikely to support them. It allows Mitch McConnell to bring a bill forward that would, in fact, increase COVID relief checks. But it certainly wouldn't pass the Senate in its current form, or pass the House in its current form. And so this is his way of trying to kind of delicately address the issue of increasing stimulus relief checks or COVID relief checks, while at the same time, making it more difficult for Democrats to support that increase.
Okay. This talk all of a sudden of election security, why would that be brought up here? As you say, a poison pill. There's, of course, but Donald Trump is claiming, without evidence, that the voter fraud cost him this re-election.
Yeah, of course, this has been ongoing now for, well, since November 3rd, since before November 3rd, really. We've heard a lot about this. What McConnell has put forward is the idea that a commission would be formed to investigate election practices, and specifically to examine election practices that strengthened or undermined the integrity of election administration within each state. And that might include mail-in ballots, that might include extending deadlines, right? All the things that the president has really focused in on. And so in that sense, it's meant to appease some of the president's supporters While at the same time, of course, linking it to some other demands that the president has made, including the $2,000 checks. But of course, coming up on January 3rd, which is when the House and Senate will adopt the rules for counting the votes from the Electoral College, and January 6th, when they actually will count the votes for the Electoral College, Democrats right now are not excited by the idea of questioning election security in the United States, and so therefore are unlikely to support the creation of that commission.
Mm-hmm. I was interested to see in the news that today Senator Josh Hawley, he's a Republican from Missouri, announced he would object next week when Congress convenes to certify the Electoral College vote. President Trump, as you said, has repeatedly suggested congressional intervention. This is really a last gasp, Jonathan, here to reverse the election results. And even the Senate Majority Leader, McConnell, there are reports that he has privately said, you know, don't go down this road. But now it seems that we do have, and we needed at least one Senate voice, a Republican, to object for it to go into this extra formality. Not that it would change the outcome, right, Jonathan?
Right. It won't change the outcome. So for it to change the outcome, two things have to happen. The House and the Senate both have to agree that, you know, states are contested, and then there's a debate, basically, about what suite of electors from which state is accepted. And the House will certainly not do that, right? The House is controlled by Democrats. After January 3rd, when everyone else knew, the new Congress is sworn in, the Democrats will still have a majority. And so it's dead on arrival. But what it will do is it'll force debate, basically. And so each state is supposed to be allotted a block of 2 hours, which I imagine can be changed by senatorial rules in the Senate, to debate whether or not there was electoral fraud in a particular state. Basically, this is Senator Hawley, I think, getting out in front of the 2024 presidential race, making the claim that, you know, he's a huge Trump supporter, and that if the president doesn't, in fact, run in 2024, Hawley is sort of positioning himself as the natural heir to the Trump mantle. So in terms of political theater, basically. In terms of actual effect, right, Biden will still be president. It's just going to be inaugurated on January 20th. It's not even going to, you know, this isn't going to pass the Senate. I don't think there's a majority of senators who are going to agree to do this, but it will be basically a little bit embarrassing for the GOP in particular. You're going to force a whole bunch of people to get on the record as to whether or not they support Trump's efforts to have a self-coup, essentially, and overturn the election, or whether or not they believe in the American electoral process.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River, the final Politics Wednesday of 2020. Jonathan Haseeb of Iowa State University, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, our political scientists on board for this edition. Let's finish up here with, since we're on track to talk about this transition and the efforts by some GOP leaders to overturn the election result. Rachel, I think you probably saw this on Monday. The Texas Republican, the Representative Louie Gohmert, announced he's suing Vice President Mike Pence in federal court. Here's his quote, in an attempt to overturn the election result. "We continue to hold out hope there is a federal judge who understands that the fraud that stole this election will mean the end of our republic. And this suit would ensure that the vice president will only accept electors legitimately and legally elected." This is what he said in a statement on Monday. Of course, we repeat, as we have many, many times, there has yet to be any proof of widespread fraud that Gohmert, Trump, the president's most ardent backers, continue to allege. So we have, what, 60 lawsuits all finding no ground there that the president and his allies have backed here. Zero documented instances of widespread malfeasance. Rachel.
That's right. So the lawsuit that Gohmert has filed, this falls under the Electoral Count Act of 1887. And it's a very bizarre piece of legislation. It is incredibly vague. And so while we think that this whole election process is pretty straightforward, the people go vote, in November, and then the Electoral College votes, and it's all very clear. In the actual act of counting Electoral College votes on the floor during a joint session of Congress, which will happen on November or on January 6th, is a very strange thing. And it's unclear whether Congress can simply ignore the Electoral Count Act of 1887 entirely. The thing that is clear is that the vice president is the one that presides over that joint session where Electoral College votes are counted. And there's also another provision in there that says that Congress must consider any documents purporting to be certifications of the electoral vote. Hmm. And so Gohmert is basically saying, hey, Mike Pence, since we don't know what criteria would be deemed appropriate here, and the Electoral Count Act doesn't tell us that, then Mike Pence could potentially, as the presiding officer over this session of Congress, Mike Pence could potentially introduce alternate slates of electors. And given that there are no criteria and he is the presiding officer, he could presumably accept alternative slates of electors. So this is all kind of technicality in a very strange year, right? Like, we're learning more and more about some of the weird processes that animate our public life. And this is one of them. It's unlikely to be successful. We can't, you know, I can't possibly envision a world where Gohmert's lawsuit is permitting Mike Pence to essentially say, yeah, we can get rid of the Electoral Count Act. I'll just introduce a whole bunch of alternate slates of electors and President Trump will win. But in the meantime, President Trump, of course, is saying, well, you know, that would be kind of a betrayal of his presidency. And so it's a positioning signal, as Jonathan had mentioned in the case of Hawley, same kind of positioning is going on here. I'm going to add one last thing, and that is that Mike Pence could simply say, I'm not interested in presiding over this joint session of Congress, in which case things get a lot of fun for Iowa, because if he were to bow out of the process, Chuck Grassley as Senator pro tem would step in as the presiding officer.
Very interesting. Okay. Thank you for those detailed thoughts, Rachel. Let's move on to what may possibly be the first veto override of the Trump term. The Senate appears poised to override the president's veto of a defense policy bill. The issue likely to come to a head, according to reports, either New Year's Day, that's Friday, or the following day, Saturday. That would be a rare Saturday vote. Republicans are making clear they expect to have the two-thirds vote needed to nix the president's veto of what is the National Defense Authorization Act. This would be the first time in 4 years that Congress has been able to successfully override Trump. Let's listen to traditionally one of Trump's most ardent supporters in the Senate, the Texas Republican John Cornyn. Here he is defending the 2021 defense authorization bill on the Senate floor yesterday, disagreeing with the president's veto.
Earlier this month, this legislation passed the House by a vote of 335-78. And the Senate by a vote of 84-13. Those are rare vote margins in Congress these days, and that alone is a testament to the importance of this legislation and its bipartisan support. We know the president has the constitutional authority to veto any bill for virtually any reason, and he has exercised that power with this legislation. The reasons the president has given, I don't think are frivolous at all, that they just shouldn't be tagged to this particular piece of legislation.
Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn yesterday. Evidently, the president vetoing this back just before Christmas because of a provision, does not repeal a provision, a legal shield for tech companies. Also, it requires Confederate-named bases and military installations to be renamed. Jonathan, take this one. How significant is this likely override as it looks?
I mean, it's significant in the sense that it's the first one of Trump's presidency. It's also significant in terms of policy because the bill will get passed. But of course, I mean, really, this is more about the some in the GOP now standing up to a lame duck president's whims more than a serious policy dispute, right? The president wants to keep Confederate general names on bases for some reason, and Section 230 has nothing whatsoever to do with the Pentagon, right? So the one thing that does have to do with the Pentagon, the renaming of the bases, is frivolous. The other thing that he's upset about, the president is upset about, Section 230 not being repealed, has nothing to do with the Pentagon at all. And so, you know, it may be that had he expended his political capital, say, a year or two ago on these issues, he might have been able to get them done. Now, as a lame duck president with only a few weeks left in office, enough senators, I think, are going to feel that they can safely override this issue, override his veto without getting into too much trouble, that the veto is unlikely to stand.
Right. And the exit door is fast approaching this president here. Rachel, so perhaps a little bit of an indication of when the president, this president, President Trump's power is gone, ceases to be president in about 20 days, then a key there is to watch how the GOP leaders then behave, isn't it? And this might be an early indication?
It might be an early indication. It's also another example right now where you see the split between McConnell and President Trump emerging. McConnell is very vocal in urging his conference to go ahead and vote to override the president's veto. I will note there's one policy concern in the bill that we haven't addressed yet, and that is that the bill restricts the president's ability to remove troops from Afghanistan and Germany, mm-hmm. which is something that President Trump, I think, really wanted to do before leaving the White House. He wanted to significantly draw down those troop levels. And the bill would make that very difficult. It requires a considerable review process before doing that. And so that would tie his hands on that question. And that's been less talked about, but I think equally important from a policy perspective, provision within this bill. But I mean, it's incredibly rare these days that you see bills passed with such wide margins. The fact that 109 Republicans in the House voted to override the veto, that includes Liz Cheney in Republican leadership. And so I think it's likely that the Senate will vote to override the veto.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, before we go to break, an email, and we can address this in the second half. Linda in Riverdale, Iowa, wonders what legislation you think will be introduced in the aftermath of the Trump presidency. Only have about 30 seconds for this. Jonathan will address it later in the hour. But what can you tell Linda, first of all, before this break?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I suspect there's going to be a lot more interest in election security. Of course, election security is mostly run by the states, but now there's going to be at least some, you know, in the past, Democrats have been more interested in sort of federalizing this. I mean, it hasn't been a huge interest, but there's been some, and I sort of suspect that we'll see perhaps a bit more of that.
Okay, we'll be back with Jonathan Haseed and Rachel Caulfield coming up yet to their reflections on 2020. Looking back, also, aside from the rearview mirror, we'll have them look out the front windshield to see what they find in 2021. Back in a moment. And we're back with this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer on board today, this final Politics Wednesday of the year. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, our two able political scientists giving us analysis on not only the recent weeks of politics, recent days of politics, but also toward the end of the program, I ask them to reflect on the politics of 2020 as a whole. Any takeaways there? Let's tackle this, first of all. Speaking yesterday, President-elect Joe Biden criticized the Trump administration's approach to vaccine distribution. Biden pledged to speed up distribution when he takes office, while also warning Americans about the difficult months likely that are still ahead.
The Biden-Harris administration will spare no effort to make sure people get vaccinated. I've laid out three challenges in our first 100 days. One of them is ensuring that 100 million shots have been administered by the end of the first 100 days. If Congress provides the funding, we'd be able to meet this incredible goal. It would take ramping up 5 to 6 times the current pace to 1 million shots a day. But even with that improvement, even if we boost the speed of vaccinations to 1 million shots a day, it will still take months to have the majority of the United States population vaccinated.
Okay, the president-elect yesterday. Jonathan, from his statements yesterday and previously, what can be said about how the president-elect will approach this pandemic differently than Donald Trump?
I mean, he'll certainly take it more visibly, more seriously, right? He always wears a mask in public. You know, he's appointed a number of people already, or I suppose proposed appointing them to a special coronavirus task force inside the White House, including various respected infectious disease experts. You know, Trump did take this virus seriously sometimes, but most of the time, I mean, he waffled back and forth so often that he didn't offer consistent leadership on the issue. You know, mm-hmm. So occasionally he would wear a mask. Most of the time he didn't. He said that the virus was going to go away in April like a miracle with the warm weather, and then only turned around to say, oh, I always knew it was serious, right? Biden's not going to do any of those things. Biden clearly sees that the coronavirus is a serious threat. You know, we're likely to have many thousands of more deaths between now and January 20th when Biden takes over. And basically, you know, the president, especially after his election loss, has basically just abdicated governing. He's out golfing, you know, he's talking to his friends, he's tweeting, but he's not out there being the face of U.S. government coronavirus response. And Joe Biden is certainly, at least rhetorically, going to put this front and center.
Mm-hmm. We heard the sad news this week of a Republican congressman-elect, Luke Letlow from Louisiana, died of complications from COVID. He had been set to take office on this Sunday. He was only 41 years old. I believe this is the first elected federal office holder, member of Congress to die of COVID. Rachel, your comments here on the Biden approach to this pandemic compared with the Trump approach.
Well, I think Jonathan's absolutely right. The public nature of Biden's actions, I think, is a significant change in tone and a signal to the American people about how seriously he takes it. He has this committee of advisors who have been working on this issue diligently already. And so, you know, I think one of the big changes that we're likely to see is that Joe Biden is somebody who A, knows government, and B, appreciates what government is capable of. His long experience, I think, is important here in terms of marshaling the full cooperative effects of government response in a way that Donald Trump didn't. He doesn't engage with government in the same way that Joe Biden has over his long career. I said once upon a time that Joe Biden's greatest strength in the nomination fight was that boring now looks really good, right? and this is one of those circumstances where right. An established career in Washington allows him to bring together a lot of disparate actors to coordinate a response in a way that might not have been possible under the Trump administration.
Right. To use a different picture, on a ship at sea, we've been tossed to and fro for quite a few years. And now if there's some steady waters ahead, it will be appreciated by people.
Right. And I think one other thing that I would add here is, you know, under the Trump administration, the U.S. has left the World Health Organization. And I think one of the most significant early actions that the Biden administration will take is to rejoin the World Health Organization.
Right. Jonathan, one of the things that when this presidency is judged in history, it will be history in a matter of a few days, but Operation Warp Speed, this program to develop vaccines at an unprecedented speed, will be seen on President Trump's watch as a tremendous success, something thought so unlikely and so welcome, to have a vaccine, multiple vaccines, effective, produced in an incredible amount of time.
That's right. I mean, you know, you've got to give the Trump administration credit here. They did a clever public-private partnership where basically drug makers like Pfizer and, you know, the other drug makers that are producing vaccines were basically financially backstopped. The government came out in advance and said, we're going to buy, you know, however many hundreds of millions of doses that you make, whether it works or not. And so, of course, that was a huge financial incentive for companies to work on vaccine development, and it's paid off. That said, of course, other countries have achieved similar things, right? There's a Russian vaccine. We don't know how effective it is, but the Russians claim to have a vaccine. There's a Chinese vaccine from Sinopharm, a major Chinese SOE. And then there's this Oxford University AstraZeneca collaboration. So the U.S. isn't unique in the speed of the development of the coronavirus response. But, you know, the approach the Trump administration took has been effective.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit, broaden about the Biden, broaden our discussion to the Biden transition. Rachel, 3 weeks before the inauguration, what are you seeing in the transition? What caught my eye, for instance, was on Monday, the president-elect saying that his transition team had faced, quote, obstruction from the Defense Department. So encountering in previous times what he says are roadblocks from political leaders. And he makes a distinction here between the political leaders and the people who work in these entities that are not political in nature, but also roadblocks from the not only the Defense Department, but the Office of Management and Budget. What are you seeing there, Rachel?
Well, let's not forget that it took 20 days before the Trump administration authorized cooperation with the incoming Biden transition team. And so many, you know, I think for those of us who observe this on an everyday basis, the full complexity of the executive branch of government is astounding. And so the levels of cooperation that are necessary for a smooth transition are really almost unimaginable. And so a few roadblocks with a few political leaders, particularly at the Department of Defense and particularly on national security concerns, can be a major hurdle, because any incoming administrators have to have that information about current threats, about what's going on in the world at large, what we're watching, what we know, what we don't know. Remember, for example, that in the wake of 9/11, a lot of investigatory work went back and examined the fact that there were clear signals, and there the knowledge that was a likely event was there if all the pieces had come together, right? And so during that transition team, all those pieces have to stay together in order for us to fully anticipate what a new administration is going to face. And that's why this process is so important. So many of Biden's key figures that have been named at this point, they have experience in government, which I think will be tremendously helpful. But for example, Joe Biden himself said that he still doesn't have a full knowledge of the scope of the cyber hack that happened or is ongoing, I guess, with government agencies. That's a deep concern.
Right. Rachel Caulfield with us of Drake University, Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University, are two political scientists on this final River to River of 2020 Politics Wednesday, the time quickly slipping away. Jonathan, I know with your expertise in foreign policy, I'd like you to comment on the news this week, the sentencing of democracy activists in Hong Kong, also the indictment of a newspaper publisher in Hong Kong. Can you briefly address that?
Sure. So what happened was there were 10 Hong Kong democracy activists who, you know, in the wake of the Chinese crackdown on protests in Hong Kong, tried to flee by boat to Taiwan. They got caught in Chinese territorial waters. They didn't make it. And now the Chinese government has, the court system has sentenced them to prison terms ranging from a few months up to 3 years, basically for illegally fleeing. Illegal border crossings is what it's called. This sends a clear signal that China is not going to tolerate any kind of democracy activism in Hong Kong. And this signal was made even further reinforced with the indictment and charging of Jimmy Lai, who was a very prominent Hong Kong billionaire. He publishes, among other things, Apple Daily, which is a sort of an not anti-government, but let's say less deferential to the Chinese government than the Chinese government would like. And so they're coming after him. They're coming after these other civil society activists in Hong Kong. And it's clear that China is sort of taking advantage of America's interest elsewhere and the world's interest elsewhere to do something that they've wanted to do for a long time, which is bring Hong Kong to heel. And it's a really sad story. It's an important story. And it's one that's not getting enough attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the remaining few minutes here, I'd like to have you give us your final thoughts on the political year nearly at an end. We had so many things happen, noteworthy things happen in our political on our political landscape. We had such soaring election turnout, yet Democrats did worse than expected. The Democrats defeated Trump, denied him a second term. Failed, though, to retake the Senate. For now, we'll see what happens in Georgia. Lost ground in the House and also in state legislatures. I don't know if those are any of the points you wanted to address, Rachel, but take a first crack at this as you look back at 2020 and the remarkable nature of our political year. Rachel, are you there?
I am. It's no small task to look back on 2020.
Indeed.
I think one of the things that I take away from 2020 is the role and importance of local and state policymaking that maybe people pay less attention to in a nationalized media environment. But when we look at so much of what was happening in 2020, we look at policing policy, we look at election administration, we look at vaccine distribution and mask mandates and so on and so forth. I think understanding how critical our state and local governments are to our everyday lives is a really important lesson that we can take away. Mm-hmm. I also think that from the perspective of the election, kind of combining it with the importance of state and local governments, what I take away from 2020 is a real need to focus not just on kind of investing in state and local governments, but particularly in investing in rural communities across the country and understanding those grievances that are being expressed at the ballot box. What do they mean? What are they telling us about our politics? Where are the disconnects? And how can those of us who live in more populated areas be more aware of and be more attentive to the very disparate impacts that are being felt in rural America.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, weigh in.
Well, the two political developments that are really interesting, one, which is what you mentioned, which was the basically the massive down ballot losses of Democrats around the country. This is going to have a big spillover effect for many, many years, because in places like Texas, where Democrats were hoping to at least grab one chamber of the state legislature and fail to do that, this is a redistricting year after the census. And so we're going to have states all over the country redistricting with Republican legislatures, which, of course, now the Supreme Court has said the gerrymandering is just fine, is likely to entrench Republican minority dominance for a long time. So that's a story that flew under the radar. The other one for me was the importance of national leadership just in symbolic ways, in setting tone. So Donald Trump, of course, the president has lots of formal powers, but not as many as we think in terms of what he can do domestically, right? Mostly, he can veto things, right? And of course, he can run the executive branch of government. But a lot of the president's power comes from this agenda setting power, this power of rhetoric, what Teddy Roosevelt called the bully pulpit. And President Trump, used that during a major national and international crisis. He used it very erratically. And the end result was that we have millions of Americans who got really confused messages from government. The CDC was telling them one thing and the president was telling them another. So we had these really confusing messages coming out of government. A lot of people just listened to the president, even though he has no formal power to order them to do anything. The fact that they did so reminds us once again that the power of this office is more than in just its institutional levers. It's also in its symbolic levers, the tone that it uses. And we're going to see a really dramatic transition. And I know I said two things, but I have one final third one, which is that 2020 really marked the culmination of Trump's control over the GOP. He really, as impeachment showed way back, remember, that was this year too, if we remember, back in February or
Hard to believe it was 2020, isn't it? Yeah.
It was 2020. Only Mitt Romney voted, in the face of overwhelming evidence that the president did what he was alleged to have done, only Mitt Romney voted to convict him. And so 2020 really was the apotheosis of Trump's control of the GOP. It'll be really interesting to see what happens when he's out of office, because he's going to, you know, he wants the attention. He's not going away. And it'll be interesting to see how the center of gravity shifts inside the GOP with basically a leader of the party who's out of office and is sniping from the sidelines, often against elected officials like Mitch McConnell. It's going to be something to watch.
Okay, let me ask specifically, since you referenced it there, about the power of the presidency and the rule of law in our country. We had William Barr departing his position as the U.S. Attorney General last week, a polarizing figure, to be sure. His resignation came soon after he undercut President Trump's baseless claims of widespread voter fraud earlier this month. For that, Barr was attacked by the president and his allies. There were some nice words to say on the way out of the door last week by the president. But Barr's time defined by the perception that he set aside the Justice Department's independence to advance the president's political and personal interests, undermining, for instance, his own investigation into Russia and wading into campaign issues. What do you see there when you reflect on law, the rule of law in this country, and the role specifically of that now former U.S. Attorney General Barr, Rachel?
Well, Bill Barr, you know, he's traditional Republican, Reagan Republican, right? I think one of the interesting things about Barr, to Jonathan's earlier point, first of all, his time as Attorney General will be defined by Donald Trump. He really exhibited no distinction in terms of principle or policy until the very end of his tenure. And so the vast majority of his actions are really defined by the president himself, probably, you know, more so than just about any other figure in the Trump administration. He's also somebody, as a Reagan Republican, you know, he really viewed the constraints that were put on presidential power in the wake of Watergate. He construed those as harming the office of the presidency. He's always been somebody who really views the presidency as an office that requires maximum power. And so the centralization of power within the presidency has been a goal of his. And he absolutely, you know, when you pair that with his role in a very particular administration, I think it puts him at the center of virtually all of the controversies that we have seen during the Trump administration.
Okay, let's pivot back to Joe Biden quickly in the final 90 seconds or so. Jonathan, the biggest hurdles for Joe Biden when he takes office in about 20 days, as you see them?
The biggest hurdle is the Republican Senate. You know, if he's not going to be able to get any judges appointed, or at least very few. Even potential cabinet appointees are going to run into trouble if Mitch McConnell won't let them through. And so, you know, depending on the special election in Georgia, it's very likely that Biden is going to face a hostile Senate, which is going to really constrain what he can do. It will also, he also has a legitimacy crisis, right? That Donald Trump has lied over and over again that Biden won with a rigged election. That's going to dog Biden, and it's going to, you know, it's going to, Trump's going to continue to say it from the sidelines, and it's going to hurt Biden's credibility, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, what do you see as the biggest hurdles? Add on to what Jonathan said there for the president-elect.
Yeah, institutionally, I don't think there's any question a Republican Senate would be a significant hurdle for Joe Biden. We have yet to know what the outcome of the election next week will be, but I suspect that he will face a Republican Senate, and that'll be difficult. I also expect that a Donald Trump with a Twitter account
yes.
will mean a continued continued partisan division, continued lack of support, continued you know, voices from the sidelines always questioning his actions.
What about Rachel continued rallies as a former president? Mm-hmm. That's not happened, but
or as a current candidate. I mean, I don't think it is. Yeah, I mean, like I don't think it is out of the question that we will hear Donald Trump declare his candidacy fairly early on in a Biden administration.
Okay, 4-year long run campaign for the presidency. Wow, we have that to
look
forward.
We're breaking norms every day.
Well, Rachel Caulfield, Jonathan Hasid, Rachel, Professor of Political Science at Drake University, Jonathan, Associate Professor of Political Science at Iowa State. I'm wishing you a wonderful final few hours of 2020 and look forward to your analysis in 2021. Jonathan and Rachel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you, Ben.
Okay, Happy New Year to you both and to all those listening. River to River, produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, Matt Alvarez, our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.